Recording in progress.
So we will try and have meetings, some of the meetings during plenary, especially those that deals with bills, so that we don't sit in the evening. But we have noted your apology, Honorable Breitenbach. Let's hope that we would, by then we would have dealt with most of the bills that need to be done, and voting on them would not be affected. But it's a living program. When a need arises, we will rearrange it to suit those conditions. Thank you very much. Honorable Swart.
Thank you again, and thank you for the program. I'm just a bit concerned about, and I know this is a draft program, 24th and 25th of August, the input on the cannabis bill funded. There's 2 days for departments, and there's only one morning for public input. I think we might have to revisit that to give more time for public hearings on that issue, but I'd leave that to the committee to look at. Thank you, Chair.
I think that is fair. That is very fair. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We will look at that, Honorable Swart. Thank you very much. I think we can now proceed. The man under the tree has also joined us, Honorable Mola and Honorable Horn. Good morning. Let me take this opportunity and hand over to the Deputy Minister, and also welcome the Legal Practice Council executive members, Mahmoud Lepu and the Deputy, I think it's Advocate Pratt. Good morning and you're welcome to this meeting. Deputy Minister John Jeffrey.
Thanks, Chair. Look, from my side, it's just to hand over to Advocate Doc Mashabane, the Director General of the Department of Justice, who's leading the delegation that will be making the presentation on the IJS.
DM, I think let's start with the legal practice so that...
you want to start with the legal practice. Okay, look, again, I think the DGs, the LPC may want to introduce that, although I think there is a presentation from the department.
Okay, well, that's fine. So who is starting? Is it the LPC or the department?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The department, we are just here to support the department and make sure that we answer the questions if needed. Thanks.
Good morning, Chair. I'm Ms. Lau of Department of Justice, and I will do the presentation on the draft regulations. If I could just get share screen, please. It seems it's disabled from your side.
Can we assist Committee Secretariat?
It's enabled, ma'am. You can go ahead. Thanks.
It says host disabled participant screen sharing. Should I open the slideshow at my side?
Yes, ma'am, you can. I've made you a co-host, so you've got more powers just like me now. So you can share screen. You can open it and start pressing share screen at the bottom.
It keeps on saying share screen is host disabled.
I think I will have to share it from my side. That indicates when I have to go to the next slide.
Mr. Chair, may I say something while we wait?
Okay, that's fine. Can proceed.
Thank you. Tomorrow, both Honorable Horn and myself are unavailable due to party commitments. The Honorable Self will attend in our stead. Thank you.
So on the days that we have mentioned?
No, tomorrow. tomorrow. I'm offering apologies for tomorrow for myself and learners. Jamself will, however, attend the meeting. Thank you.
Yes, on that note, Honorable Breitenbach, I have not discussed this with my party, but is it possible that at 1 o'clock tomorrow I can be released, because that is the only flight I got to Cape Town, that at that time, if we are not done, can I be released?
Of course, we're dying to see you in Cape Town.
So I think the committee will elect a chair to take over from me from 1 o'clock if we are not done. Hopefully we would be.
Chair, Honourable Wilma has her hand up.
Honourable Nivor Drachen.
Chair, shall I proceed
while we are still while we are still waiting for the slideshow, I just want to let you know that on Friday I'll be going to my second dose for vaccination, so I will be in and out for Friday's meeting, just to inform you of that.
Okay.
Of the apology of that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you. You can proceed, department.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. As I said, I'm Ms. Lowe of Department of Justice, and thank you for this opportunity to do a presentation on proposed amendments to the regulations regarding practical vocational training of candidate attorneys and pupils. Next slide. The majority of the sections of the Legal Practice Act came into operation late in 2018, and then the Legal Practice Council was established, and the first regulations in terms of the Act were published in August 2018. Next slide. Section 94(1)(i) of the Act provides for regulations on practical vocational training requirements for candidate legal practitioners. Section 26 of the Act has to be read with Section 94, and Section 26 provides for the minimum qualifications and practical vocational training. Section 26(1)(a) and (b) provide for the qualification requirements, and 1C requires a candidate legal practitioner to satisfy all the practical vocational training requirements as prescribed by the Minister of Justice. And then prescribed is defined in Section 1 as prescribed by regulation. Any regulations must be approved by Parliament before publication in the Gazette. The current Regulation 6 of the regulations that were published provides for the practical vocational training requirements of candidate attorneys. In terms of Regulation 6(1), a candidate attorney has two options. He or she can serve under a practical vocational training contract for 24 months and complete coursework of at least 150 hours during or after vocational training, or serve under contract for 12 months and complete coursework of at least 400 hours, but that is then prior to the practical vocational training contract. And Regulation 610 of the current regulations provides for the modules that the above mentioned coursework must comprise of. The current Regulation 7 provides for practical vocational training requirements of pupils. In terms of Regulation 7(1), a pupil must serve under contract for 12 months and
complete coursework of at least 400 hours prior or during contract. Regulation 7.9 provides for the modules of the coursework. The Legal Practice Council requested amendments to regulations 6 and 7. Reasons for this include the challenge of securing necessary training as well as the inequity in relation to the training itself have been identified as some of the major barriers to entry into the legal profession. The Council took into account the differences between the attorneys and advocate professions, and it foreseen that a compulsory uniform practical vocational training program will be implemented that must be completed by all candidate legal practitioners. The program will have dedicated coursework aimed at empowering candidate legal practitioners on different areas of the law and a satisfactory standard of learning. The Council did take into consideration the views of all relevant stakeholders. The Council also recognised the developments in the legal profession in relation to the same tertiary education law graduates are now exposed to. And there are also an increasing number of attorneys who have the right of appearance in the Superior Courts. I will now proceed with a discussion of the amendment regulations. Regulation 1 of the amendment regulations defines the regulations as those previously published. Regulation 2 amends the classification of the regulations. It just inserts as new regulation 7 capital I in the classifications. Regulation 3 of the amendment regulations amends Regulation 6 that relates to candidate attorneys. It's a small technical amendment to Regulation 6.6 to align the period of previous experience that an attorney of legal aid South Africa or at a legal aid institution must have before they can take on a candidate attorney. At the moment, there's a small technical difference between those attorneys, legal aid attorneys and other, and this only aligns it. And then Regulation 3B deletes sub-regulations 6, 10 and 11. Sub-regulation 10 lists the modules of coursework of candidate attorneys, and this will now be replaced by the provisions of the new regulation 7 capital I, which I will discuss later. And sub-regulation 11 is then reenacted as the new regulation 7A4. Regulation 4 of the amendment regulations amends regulation 7 that relates to pupils. Regulation 4A of the amendment regulations amends regulation 7.1 that provides for the time period of vocational training of pupils. And they will now have two options which will enhance access to training and allow for flexibility. And those two options will be a 12-month practical vocational training plus 150 hours coursework during or after training, or 400 hours coursework before practical vocational training plus 12 months training. Regulation 4B of the amendment regulations amends regulation 7.5 just to effect a small amendment to the period of previous experience that a legal aid advocate must have before they can engage a pupil. And it aligns the required years to that of other advocates. It's similar to that of the attorneys. Next slide. Sub-Regulation 7 currently provides that an advocate may engage one pupil at a time, and this is amended to allow for two pupils. And Sub-Regulation 7-8 is then consequently also amended to refer to this two-pupil limit. Regulation 4E deletes Sub-Regulations 9 and 10. Sub-Regulation 7-10 lists the modules of coursework, and it's replaced now by 7A. And Sub-Regulation 10 is reenacted by the new Regulation 7A4. Regulation 5 of the amendment regulations inserts a new Regulation 7A to provide for this uniform program of structured coursework. This would mean that the structured coursework of candidate attorneys and pupils will be the same. And the modules are listed in the new Regulation 7A sub 2. Regulation 7A3 provides that the council may determine the course content, and also it may determine that it may be done by face-to-face, e-learning, digital learning, or distance learning, or a combination. And these are all measures to enhance access to training. Regulation 6 of the amendment regulations provides that it will come into operation on date of publication in the Gazette. Comment was invited from stakeholders, and it was taken into account, and the presidency exempted the department from conducting a SIAS. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Law. Thank you for the presentation. Can I now note hands from members who want to make input or ask questions? Honorable Swart.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you for the input. I just wanted to ask, it seems very straightforward, but I'm just interested about the comment, any comments that any organizations that were opposed to the proposed amendments to the regulations. You did indicate that comments were received and taken into consideration. Were there any objections to the proposed regulations from any organization? And if so, what were the objections and what was done to accommodate any objections? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Swartz. Honorable Newgot, Kachin.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation from the department. It's just the last part I would like clarity on. It says that the presidency policy and research exempted the department from doing a social economic assessment report. I'd just like to understand why that was done. Is it something that will be done in the presidency, or yes, if I could just get clarity. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other member? Just few issues.
Recording in progress.
A privilege from the bar associations. So what is the hours done? If I can get clarity. To you, Ms. Lowe.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I will respond to questions. I think that the legal practice expert will be in the best position to respond to your hours issue. First, I want to say regarding the comments that were received, the only comments that were not in favour of the proposed amendments were received from the Cape Bar Council, the General Council of the Bar. And the basic principle behind their objection is that the distinction between training for candidate attorneys and pupils will blur, and they feel that there should be a differentiation during the whole process. This comment were submitted to the minister, and he did take it into consideration, but he decided to proceed with the draft regulations as submitted by the Legal Practice Council. And then the question regarding the socioeconomic impact assessment. When the first set of regulations were done in 2018, the department did a full SIAS on the regulations, including regulations 6 and 7 that are being amended now. So as this is only an amendment to existing regulations, the presidency felt that it is unnecessary to conduct SIAS on these amendments only. Thank you, Chair. I don't know if that is a satisfactory response.
I think if members are unsatisfied, they will indicate. We have Honourable Swart, who has raised his hand.
Chair, no, I was unaware of any objections to the regulations, and it's helpful that the information has been provided, but I would like to a copy of those objections to understand the nature of accounts. I do understand the Minister has considered it, but we, as it's incumbent for us to also look into that and see what is the nature of the objections as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Can you ask that that is sent to us?
I will send to Mr. Romano.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. Sorry for abusing my office, Ms. Law. I just forgot one question. If you look at the current 6 months training, which was mainly for attorneys before this proposal, it was quite packed. The type of modules you needed to do in 6 months was quite a packed program. And now you are including other courses or other modules, which makes it to be sort of, I think, 24 modules, which is going to be even more packed, but still in 6 months. Will it be fair to students? Well, that was my story for coming back, and sorry, members.
Thank you, Chief. Could I ask the Legal Practice Council to respond to these questions, unless they want me to, but I think they are in the best position to do so.
Mahmoud Lepo, we can't hear you properly.
Yeah, I'm saying that we've got representatives from the Legal Practice Council who assisted us with the drafting of, especially of the hours. Melissa, and Christine.
Thank you very much, Chair. If I may proceed, my name is Melissa Murray. I'm the Senior Manager for Education and Training here at the Legal Practice Council. I may proceed to answer your questions in this regard. I'll be assisted by Christine Quinter, who is a member of the Education Committee, as well as Nicholas T, who is a consultant for the Education Committee at the Legal Practice Council. If I can just begin by saying that the three requirements that all candidate legal practitioners need to meet in order for them to be admitted as legal practitioners. The first is that they need to do the PBT program, which is the structured coursework that we are dealing with now. The second part is their training, which they would do with an attorney or under a accredited bar. And finally, they would need to write LPC admission exams in order to enter the profession. So the LPC is setting the exams for pupils and for candidate attorneys from 2021 onwards. And those are the three requirements that all candidates would need to satisfy in order to be admitted. So when it comes to, through you, Chair, the first question you asked was, what is the difference between the 400-hour and the 150-hour program? Both of those programs would prepare candidates to write the admission exams. So all the topics that are in the regulations would be covered in both of those, in both of the courses. The 150-hour course is focused on exam preparation. It focuses on those modules that the candidates need in order to pass the exams. The 400-hour program is a lot more detailed, of course, with there being a lot more hours, but the same content is covered in both. So for the 400 hours, you might find there's a lot more practical components. There's a lot more mock trials or drafting exercises, because the 400 hours traditionally has always allowed candidate attorneys to reduce their service down from 2 years down to 1 year, or that being 12 months. So Chair, through for the first question, what is the difference in the content? There is no difference in the modules that are covered. It's just in how detailed and how much time is spent on each of those modules. If I can then go on to your second question, Chair, which was, why does the same not apply to pupils getting a reduction in their year of service? Chair, the period that candidates need to serve in order to be admitted, the minimum would be 1 year for pupils and candidate attorneys. Pupils are able to do their six-month training during their 1 year, as they always have been. Candidate attorneys are also able to do that six-month training during their 1 year. So it's uniform in that way, where a candidate, whether they want to be an attorney or an advocate, could complete the 400-hour course within their 1 year of training, and then write the exams after that, and then become admitted as legal practitioners. The 150-hour course would not allow somebody to reduce their period of service. So it would only be the 400-hour course, because of how much more detailed it is, that would allow a candidate to not have to do a two-year training. And then, Chair, your last point, if I can just answer that, the current 6 months training, as you said, it is quite packed, it is. When these regulations, or if these regulations come into being, we will then re-look at the amount of time that is spent on each module so that it will be fair to candidates. We won't place any undue burden on the candidates going forward. So we will then look at how we emphasize certain modules in the training course. But we did find that it's important. For example, pupils have never done courses in wills and estates or bookkeeping. They focus more on motion court and trial advocacy courses. But we found that all candidates should be doing those type of courses, because an attorney would get right of appearance in the High Court and then will benefit from the trial advocacy training. On the same side, the pupils would benefit from wills and estates, bookkeeping if they're going to practice with a Fidelity Fund certificate, and if they're ever going to represent a client where they might be contesting a will. So when we had a look at the types of modules that we've been asking all candidates to do, we felt that it would then cover the profession for the candidates moving forward. It would also allow them to change between becoming an advocate, an attorney, whatever they're able to access in terms of either pupillage or articles after their 6 months training, it will allow them to do so. Chair, that's what I have. I'm happy to answer any other questions or to hand over to my colleagues from the Legal Practice Council. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Murray. Mamukunda.
Yes, good morning, Chair, and good morning to the honourable members. I just wanted to add to what Melissa said about the 400 hours. What that also does, it enables candidate attorneys who were not able to find articles, contracts of articles, to actually do the course, because it says before, unlike the 150 hours. And that means that they can do the 6 month course instead of sitting at home and not being able to do. So it provides access. And then after they've had it, they're also more marketable. In relation to the question that Advocate or Honorable Swart asked in relation to the objections, and I take note that he has requested the actual objections. We also, before we forwarded it to the ministry, we also looked at that. The two main objections from the two advocate bodies were that they're concerned that candidate legal practitioners writing one examination is a step too far towards fusion. It represents fusion, which obviously they are opposed to. That was the first concern. The second concern was that they were now, pupils were asked to do practice management and wills and estates. And they felt that those courses are irrelevant to advocates because they're not going to wind up estates and they don't need to know practice management accounts. We call it, in the old days, we called it trust account. This thing now we call it practice management. And we considered that quite seriously. And in the first instance, there's no question of fusion because the pupils will be trained separately. The pupils will undergo exactly the same training that they have done prior to this amendment. They will get all the intensive practical training. So the PVT has two components. The one is the structured course, which is before yourselves, the amendment of Regulations 6 and 7. And that's the 150 hours. So the only difference now is that pupils will have to do that, but they get exactly the same course in the course of the year. The second issue is, which is what Melissa has alluded to, that this will enable candidate legal practitioners to move more easily between the two branches. Because at the moment, if you're an advocate and you want to become an attorney, and it's difficult at the bar, particularly especially young women and young people to get work at the bar. So you may decide after you've done this thing, actually, I don't want to go to the bar. I want to become an attorney. At that point, you do not have to write, as at the moment, you have to write a practice management course. You have to do that. You don't have to do that because you've already written that. So we felt that will make it easy. It eases access to the profession. It eases moving between the two. And it equips advocates, wills and estates. You invariably will get incredible disputes around wills and estates. And you should have an understanding, at least that 150 hours. It's not 2 or 3 years training. That 150 hours equipped with that. The exam will deal with that. So we felt, so we considered it and we felt that the concern around fusion is not warranted because we are not changing anything. We're just asking candidate advocates to do customary law, wills and estates, and practice management course. Those are the three courses that they didn't have. But in relation to all the other subjects that are currently in Regulation 7, none of those subjects have been removed. They are all in this current amended Regulation 7. So nothing has been taken away. Two or three have been added, and that's the only change that have been made, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mamukota, generally when people start sometimes to practice, I think what is interesting with your proposal is that sometimes others go to the bar and they find it very difficult, or suddenly they see that they want to be attorneys. So I think with this one, with this proposal, what is attractive about it? It will make it easy for people to move from one to the other seamlessly. Thank you very much. But my question is, if you look at other jurisdictions, even in Africa, in England, Scotland, that 400 hours, at the end of it, they will call it a diploma in legal practice or postgraduate diploma in legal practice. And here we just call it practical legal course. Is it not, have you never thought of changing the name to be a diploma in legal practice?
Chair, if I could ask the Legal Practice Council to respond to that question, please.
Thank you, Chair. If I may respond? Thank you, Chair. Just with regard to it, it is practical legal training. It is training that is practical in nature, more advanced than what they've just covered in their LLB degree. So it wouldn't be another qualification, because this six-month course, or even the 150-hour course, it assists candidates to write the examinations to become legal practitioners. So it wouldn't be a standalone qualification. If we were to do so, we would have to align it to the SACWA and the CHE standards. But the purpose of this course is to provide practical training that the candidates wouldn't have received at university, and is the bridge between university and practice. So there wouldn't be a purpose for it to also be a qualification in itself, because having done this course and after you've done your pupillage or your articles, you can then go on and become an attorney or an advocate, which is the goal of the candidates.
What I'm saying is that when you look at other jurisdictions in Zambia, in Kenya, in other countries, it's the same process, but they call it a diploma in practical legal training. That is the issue. I am not dealing with the content now. I'm just asking why are we not, even if it needs SACWA's processes, but why are we not calling the diploma in legal training to be in line with all other jurisdictions?
Thank you, Chair. I think it's always just been the practical component of the training that candidates need to be admitted. So this hasn't been something that we've considered for candidates. It's always just been the bridge that the candidates needed between practice and the university degree, as the university degree is very theoretical, and then this was a practical component. But Chair, I don't know if anyone else from the council can assist you, but it's not something we considered for this.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, because even in other jurisdiction, it is the practical side. It is the practical legal course. But it's generally the name of the course. But we do accept that we have not considered it.
Can you hear me, sir?
Mr. T.
Nicholas T. I'm an advocate.
Yes.
I'm a member of the Johannesburg Bar. We are affiliated to the GCB. I don't want to get into the polemic about whether or not there's fusion. In Nidel, in the olden days, I was a very pro-fusion, but Nidel voted to keep the profession separate. What I would like to do is just to add 2 points here. The name of the practical vocational training comes from Section 26 of the Act. And with regard to the question of whether there's going to be a fight about fusion or not, may I just ask the honourable members of Parliament and colleagues and ladies and gentlemen to consider that the purpose of Section 26 is a minimum. It is a minimum qualification, and I personally believe that all practitioners should have that bedrock of a minimum. And that minimum is very important. It does not mean that advocates don't get further training. It does not mean that the bars cannot have their own training. What it means is that we need a bedrock for a minimum. Now, I was party working under Advocate Ismail Hussein SC to write the norms and standards for the Legal Practice Council, and we based it as best we could to try and get this minimum across the board. What Regulation 7A does is it now will confirm the fact that there will be a minimum. There are 2 points, though, to raise, which I would ask the members of Parliament to consider very, very much. Firstly, this is a training course to allow people to enter into the profession. We call them the practical vocational training, and in order to get the practical vocational training, you need a PVT contract. Now, that is where the blockage into the profession is. And the reason is very simple. If the 2,500 LLB graduates from all of our universities are required to get a PVT contract before they can get into the profession, the bottleneck is that there are insufficient current legal practitioners who are able to give the PVT contract. And so there are proposals which the Legal Practice Council is considering. For example, the Legal Practice Council has legal practitioners who are in practice, and they have a role of legal practitioners who are not in practice. And those people are a resource that is untapped. And we may, and I would ask Parliament to consider it, tapping this enormous resource of thousands and thousands of lawyers, fully qualified. Many of them have had more than the 4 years or 3 years experience necessary as the entry point. And then to log the entry point into everybody having this absolute minimum standard, because Section 26 is clear. We don't want a maximum standard. We want a minimum standard for everybody. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate Chair. Honorable Sart.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the inputs. And I do appreciate the explanations. Just touching now what Advocate T says, I'm in that category of attorneys that are not practicing, as are other members of Parliament possibly. But I'd like to just ask him practically, how would that, you've asked us as members of Parliament to assist, maybe the Legal Practice Council and you can guide us in what process that would take. Would it be further amendments to the regulations? How would that take place? Because obviously, at the end of the day, we want to allow access and remove hurdles to access to the profession, as you indicated, for the 2,500 LLB graduates. So I welcome that input. And I also welcome the explanation of the different training modules. I just still need to look at the objections, and I'm interested with Advocate T on the council from the Bar Association. One presumes then that you, as part of the Legal Practice Council, considered the objections and are happy with the regulations as they are formulated at the moment. Because I can understand the argument, and it's a good argument or a good proposal for those members that go to the bar and find it difficult and then go to the sidebar, that they would have had training in walls, etc. But I'm not sure whether it doesn't also create an obstacle, because administration of estates is complicated. Bookkeeping is these are not straightforward issues that could well also present an obstacle for those people that are determined to go to the bar and they say, but why do we need this? So I appreciate that the Legal Practice Council has taken all this into consideration, but I think, Chair, we also need to look into this from our perspective, and I understand we can either accept or reject. We can't amend regulations, but I think it's something we do want to bear in mind as we want to broaden access to the profession and balance the different needs. And I'm pleased that there's no question about fusion, but this has been an ongoing process to try to find the best access to justice. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Shall I reply to that, Mr. Chair?
You can. You can, Advocate Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Swart, yes, I'm pleased that you're an attorney. I was also first an attorney before I became an advocate, so I'm qualified in both fields. And I know from my own experience that writing the attorney's exam was much more difficult and onerous in terms of the amount of work that we had to cover compared to the bar exam. But at the same time, passing the bar exam, because we weren't those days getting paid while doing pupillage, was psychologically more difficult. So these regulations are going to do two things, we hope. We get a bedrock which keeps the professions divided, as is required in terms of the Legal Practice Act. The Legal Practice Act is quite clear. There are candidate legal practitioners who are going to be attorneys. There are candidate legal practitioners who are going to be pupils, that's advocates. And the Act also provides for a new type of advocate, an advocate with a trust account, which is very analogous to an attorney who is the sole practitioner. Now, we are speaking to the Legal Practice Council to try and find a way to get, a practical way, to get people on the non-practicing role to be able to sign up practical vocational training contracts. We do recognize that those are people who have been in the Chapter 9 institutions, for example. They are legal advisors who would be in corporations. They are any attorney or advocate who has formally done at least 3 years or 4 years, depending on what is needed, of training. So it is an untapped resource. But they will not be able, in their current position, to oversee. And the Legal Practice Council, therefore, is looking at accrediting institutions who could do this intense training. So in order to get more people into the profession, we do need to open up the PVT. It's absolutely vital. And the reason is practical. And Mr. Swart, you will understand this. Getting articles when I was young was easy. I phoned my uncle, who was a partner at Weber Wenzel, and he organized it for me. So I had the massive level of privilege. When I was moving from being an attorney into the bar, I did the same thing. I phoned a friend. Now, the overwhelming majority of human beings inside South Africa do not have that level of privilege. So we've got to open the PVT route. We've got to open the PVT route. And I can tell you, I know that the Legal Practice Council is considering this very much. They are in a little bit of a hiatus at the moment, and that is that there are elections and there's going to be a new council coming in soon. But you will see there will be very good proposals coming from the Legal Practice Council, how to harness more PVT contracts, how to get the transformation that's required. And the transformation is written into our preamble of the Legal Practice Act. The object of that transformation is that we must try as fast as possible to get the legal profession to replicate the demographic proportions of our country. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lepu, then Deputy Minister, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair, Honourable Mawanisha, and to the Members of Parliament. We really appreciate the opportunity you have given us to present why we need the amendments. We act, for us, they are very important to see the changes that the Legal Practice Act is bringing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable Deputy Minister John Jeffrey.
Sorry, just a collapsed screen. Chair, I've got nothing more to say. I think it's the issues have been dealt with. It would then be for the committee to consider the regulations. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. We will await the information that was requested by Honourable Swart. In terms of our program, we will be considering this matter very soon, because we want to ensure that it goes before the House before this term ends. So we would be coming to it to deliberate very soon as the committee. But one issue that is not related to this one, which I think that the department, I think even the Legal Practice Council, need to look at. The information that is in the websites of some of the universities is extremely outdated. For instance, they are still using pre-2014 Act if you go to UCT, if you go to their website where they say how do you become an attorney and an advocate. In fact, they are using the old Act and not the new Act, which is totally misleading. I do think that those stakeholders need to be engaged, because it would be important that what goes to the public is the recent information, the 2014 Act, not the 1979 and 1964 Act. I think it will be important to keep your eyes on those issues. And I think, I still do think that I would be interested to know when you say that you have not considered the issue of PVT and the issue of postgraduate diploma as in other jurisdictions. I would be interested in your thoughts at some point as to whether you have really consider those jurisdictions and whether your views are still the same, that you don't need to do that. It will be interesting to hear your views on those issues. But thank you very much to the council, to the department, and to the deputy minister for the presentation. I think that's quite enlightening. And I think we have gained a lot as the committee. We will be coming back to you soon as to what our decision is. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. You are free to stay and to hear other presentations, but if you've got other issues to attend to, you are also free to attend to your other important duties, especially members of the council. Can we have the presentation on the integrated justice system? As the DG is preparing to flight the presentation, and welcome DG. Can we have a 2 minute break so that they can be able to take down the slide and flight the new slide?
The slides on the screen are the new slides.
New slides, yes. But I'm speaking on behalf of Honourable Breitenbach. She needs a 2 minute break.
Okay.
Oh, buena.
Welcome back, Deputy Minister.
Chair, no, again, as I started last time, this is, I'm handing over to the DG to introduce his team and to lead the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DG.
Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, good morning, and thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to make this presentation on the modernization program of the department. And we would like to profusely apologize for having only submitted in the evening or at night yesterday. We could still have done better. We could have submitted it in the morning. But in our quest to try and submit a quality document, we ended up having those delays. I'm accompanied by my colleagues, the Deputy Director General, Advocate Skosana, who is the head of the court services, and this program is a critical part of the work that we do in the courts, and also the Deputy Director General for Corporate Services, whose responsibility includes the modernization program, DDG Connie Mamecha, and other senior members of the department. As honorable members know, the modernization program is part of the strategic objectives of the department's threat plan for the next 5 years. And as such, in our annual performance plan, we have prioritized it as such to make sure that we achieve the modernization imperatives of our justice system. Now, in our presentation, what we'll do, we'll present firstly on the department's IT program, the modernization program that focuses on the work that the department has to do in two ways. One, for the department, and two, but for the service deliverer, the deliverer of the justice services. But then thereafter, then we move into the integrated criminal justice system, and we show how and what we're seeking to achieve through modernization in the courts. And we'll close by going through the integrated justice program, which is also a broadly a program of government focusing on the entirety of the justice value chain. So my colleague, who is the acting Chief Information Officer, Anton Katz, will do the presentation focusing on the modernization and the strategic focus of the department. And Advocate Skosana will move and focus on the ICT environment in the courts, including the challenges. But it will take the presentation through to the end of the Integrated Justice System program. And then the colleagues will assist when we are expected to respond to questions from the honorable members. Chairperson, with your permission, I would like to invite Mr. Hentin Kurtz, the acting CIO, to take us through the first slides of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, DG. Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Like the DG is saying, I'm Hinton Katz and I'm the acting CIO of the department. As the DG has alluded to, the Minister has also put in the center modernization for judicial reform. It is in that context then that as the department, we are driven to provide equitable access to all our services to our citizens through our modernization program. The idea behind the modernization journey is to create channels providing access to information and services over and above the existing court channels that we have. As such, it allows relevant processes to be managed online in their entirety and expose information to the public and thereby bringing services closest to where it is needed. Our modernization program not only aims to make it easy to access justice services, as the DG was alluded to, but also provides a platform from which we can deliver future online services whilst enhancing the ability of our internal employees to carry out the task as efficiently as possible. If we can move to the next slide. So our modernization is around four broad themes. The first theme is, how do we provide access to justice services to the IT, to the public? And we call that IT for public. Basically, what we do there is we are looking at the online channels like internet, mobile, etc. Third-party channels like banks, using leveraging our connectivity to banks like Home Affairs, SARS and the like, to actually bring the services seamlessly closer to the public. A big part of that would be to look at how do we digitalize and digitize our internal processes for efficiency, such as case tracking, our financial management, etc. In order for the work to be done, we need to look at our internal productivity. How do we enable our internal resources to provide the services as efficiently as they can using IT? And the last one is obviously to maintain and make sure that the systems that we provide online or productivity-wise for our internal employees are up and running 99% of the time. And overarching this would be improving our governance and ICT capabilities. As far as our modernization roadmap is concerned, we have focused on three of the four themes for the purpose of this committee meeting, looking at how do we provide the IT for public, IT business, IT for business, and the internal administration. My colleague is just slighting the roadmap in terms of where our priority for this financial year is. We are looking specifically at online services to the public, things like maintenance, deceased estates, trust, expungement, civil protection orders, NRSO, as well as court audio-visual solutions. The roadmap is slighted there. My apologies, honorable members. The orange is in progress, and you probably can't see that. I'm struggling to see that. While the green dot relates to completed. So far, for the most part, on all of these online initiatives, we are either in testing or piloting process phase, with the intention to have all of these deployed or ready for deployment by the end of December, starting the national deployment from January onwards. The reason for the long piloting and the testing is because we're taking a very cautious approach to specifically the online solutions, in as far as we don't want to put out there a system that is wonky and fall over, as it might lead to a lot of frustration on the part of the public, as well as a reluctance to adopt the system. If we can move to the next slide. On a high level, just more focus on specific items that as part of our roadmap we are prioritizing for the public. The first one there would be as the audio-visual remand system. The audio-visual remand system allows for the remote remand of cases via video links. This is more especially important during the times of COVID. One of the things that we've done in the last 6 months is to deploy an additional 80 new sites where we have completed AVR. Let's take this, the total of sites that are currently connected via AVR to 65. We are continuously looking at additional requirements in that regard as well. Maintenance online. The maintenance online portal will provide an online channel for where people can apply for maintenance. And we also have another system to which this will be linked, whereby the payment is automated. It's already done. But as far as the online portal for maintenance is concerned, we have started a pilot process at Point Court in Durban to a targeted user group. Like I said, is to test basically the technical stability and the user experience before we roll out to nationally. Deceased Estates Online is another portal that we are focusing on that will provide for the registration of deceased estate cases. This project is currently in test phase, and the pilot will start in September at the Master's Office Pretoria. Here we will use the trusted, some of our trusted agents to actually test the system and give us feedback so we can deal with additional enhancements. Trust Online is the same as far as we will provide an online channel for the registration of trusts, and we will be testing it at the Master's Office. We'll run a pilot at the Master's Office starting September 21 as well. Expungements online will allow for the application of expungements online, and it's currently in test phase, and the pilot will be starting in September as well at National Office in Pretoria. Civil Online will provide an online channel for the registration of civil cases. It's currently in test phase, and the pilot is planned in MC Polokwane for September 21 as well. Protection orders online provide for application of domestic violence and harassment protection orders online. This is also in development phase at the moment, and we're planning to start a pilot at MC Pretoria from November onwards. NRSO is for the application of clearance and removal against the National Register of Sexual Offences, and it's currently in development phase and the pilot planned for November 2021. On the court audio-visual system, court audio-visual system will allow for remote testimony as well as the consolidation of language translation services, where you can either provide testimony on from wherever you are and access language translation services also from wherever you are, as opposed to having these translators having to move to specific places where they are needed. The project is currently in procurement phase, and the rollout is expected to start in 2022. The last part facing the public is cashless courts. We are implementing speed points all over the country as a means to make it easier to pay for bail and also reduce the cost we are paying for cash in transit and holding cash bail monies at the courts. To date, we have rolled out 158 courts with these speed points, and we are still planning to roll out more. Next slide, please. Like I indicated, then the next part is to look at how do we enable our internal resources to be able to do their job. The first part is video conferencing. In the new normal, video conferencing plays a big role in terms of having meetings and follow up on things. And we have deployed 18 boardrooms so far, and this is an ongoing project as well. A big part of our issues at the moment is that our infrastructure for telephony is in various stages of disrepair, and we have a project to replace 283 sites with new PAB access so that communication between the courts and the public can be facilitated. This deployment is currently underway, and we expect it to be finalized in 2022 as well. The network upgrade, a lot of talk has been going into requirements for Wi-Fi and the slow justice network. And one of the big projects that we are currently rolling out is to upgrade the bandwidth across all our sites as far as we can, because as you know, the majority of our courts are in outlying areas where there's aging copper infrastructure, which is difficult to do. But as far as we can, we are replacing the network infrastructure to these courts. We are also, as we are moving into a more digital space, we have started a project to roll out Wi-Fi to some of our courts. We are planning 50 additional sites, additional to the 42 that we've already done in this financial year, which will allow members that visit our courts, if they absolutely have to be able to access at the courts our online systems. Our laptops and desktops, these are tools of trade, to be able to allow our people to be able to do their jobs more, especially when it comes to working remotely due to the pandemic. We are rolling out 8,000 personal computers, which are 4,000 desktops and 4,000 laptops. And this is currently in process and should be concluded by 2022. This, however, is a rolling target, because as we are replacing desktops and laptops, some of them are going out of warranty, end of life, and we need to replace that. But for this year, we're looking at 8,000. Next slide, please. The last slide is that we thought that it's probably just a good idea to also indicate what are those risks that might impede on our modernization journey. On the main, there are three of them. The first one, like I've mentioned a number of times, are the aging infrastructure. We are in the process of replacing our infrastructure, but because of the time that it takes to do that, it kind of impedes on our deployment. For instance, as it stands today, we have limited pilot environment infrastructure, which means we have to look at prioritizing certain aspects that we need to pilot against others whilst we are busy upgrading our infrastructure. The next risk that is impacting, if you can just go back to the previous slide, please, that are impact, yes, that one, impacting on our modernization drive is functional support. As you can imagine, now that our services are going online, there's a requirement to have support for these online services. We have had some of the services in place, and it had come to expiry. We are in the process of getting these services back and up and running, but by the time that our services go online, we should have the functional support services, service desk in place to actually assist the public with regards to any queries that they might have in terms of accessing online services or problems that we might experience. The last one is around resource constraints. This is both on development resources and internal resources. The department is in the drive of finalizing its permanent structure, its macro structure and the likes. But in the meantime, because we are in a transitionary phase, that impacts on our ability to achieve all of the targets that we set as far as modernization is concerned. Thank you, Chair. That is where I will end, and then I will hand over to the DDG Court Services.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. J.B. Skhosana. I will take the presentation to its end, and I'll focus mainly on the ICJS and IJS. We woke this morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, with a heavy heart, having lost one of our trusted senior managers, Mr. Paul Mchimunya, who happened to work in the same court when he was a prosecutor and when I was a presiding at that time. And what I realized when I was working this presentation is that we were working at a time when we were on the manual basis, maintenance cases. We all wrote on longhand on the court, on the bench at the time. And may his soul rest in peace. Honourable Chair, I'm just going to take it forward from where we started. I think the ICJS, from a concept point of view, the ICJS is an integrated criminal justice strategy that puts all departments involved in the big matters really chained together. And I think it focuses on one, the policy overarching policy intervention, which led to capacity, legislation, policy, whatever, while the IJS focus on the modernization aspect. Therefore, the IJS is the modernization angle of the whole ICJS project. And I think all the departments in the justice cluster, and more importantly, those ones who form part of the Justice Ministry, Justice, Correctional Services, and NPA, are key stakeholders in this value chain. And obviously with the social development and Home Affairs playing a very critical role as well. I'm trying to move the slide. Yes, now the ICT environment, of course, is largely dependent on the role of the NPA and the DOJ interface, being the recipient of what comes from the police perspective. So what happens is that the police will then process all their case dockets, whatever, in terms of the CAS system, and is received by the NPA in terms of the ECMS system, and is then processed through the court system, through the ICMS system. The ICMS system is the CAS system, the case administration system. Then the ECMS, the electronic case management system. The ICMS is the electronic case management system. So when they get then channeled through the process, both ensures that there's a seamless process that runs across the whole value chain, with IJS providing the IT infrastructure and to enable that kind of process. And therefore, as I continue, I'll indicate some of the challenges which relate to this kind of modernization, which basically is large systems challenges, network connectivity, the Wi-Fi integration, slowness of the systems, and the capacity challenges in terms of human resource capacity, training, and change management. These are those challenges that are within the justice space. But obviously, as I will indicate further, they overlap with the challenges across the entirety of the JCPS system, etc. And I think the ICJS has been basically introduced with a view to addressing those challenges. And I think the minister's role and his decision to centralize modernization is very key with process. But I also wanted to indicate that the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic basically provided an opportunity for us to have more emphasis on the modernization. And I think life has shown that there's no other way that we could go back to where we come from. Modernization is the road that we must all undertake. Now, what we are using in terms of the entire value chain and looking into how we're going to optimize the whole modernization process, there's been a dedicated focus on the two provinces, KZN and Gauteng. And the focus has basically been imposed by firstly the backlogs arising from COVID, but secondly the unrest that erupted recently in KZN and spread to Gauteng, as well as the instability in the Western Cape. So I think what this process allows us to do, because we have been able to create an interface and integrated approach with police, NPA, and all the stakeholders who are using those provinces to see how best we can perfect or improve our interaction, both in terms of the IT systems and also in terms of the data management. As Deputy Minister will recall, it's at this time that we've realized that subs are not on the teams, they are using a different process in terms of their IT platform. And we're trying to find ways so that we can harmonize our system moving forward. And this basically talks to the interventions of the ICJS. The next slide, Chair, shows how that integration also impacts or enhance interface with the judiciary. There's a structure established by the judiciary, which is called the JAIC, Judicial and Administration ICT Strategy Steering Committee, led by JP Mlambo. So all the parallel sites, the case line in Gauteng, etc., derive from this structure where my colleague, Ms. Mameja, and I participate. And basically, JAIC focuses to provide direction oversight on the use of IT across the
across the justice value chain, prioritize the major IT enablers and initiatives, monitor and evaluate the implementation and business benefits of the system, ensuring IT policies, processes, procedures that are standardized and adhered to by the judiciary and administration, providing strategic leadership and prioritization of major IT initiatives, and leading the change management processes required to ensure the effective use of IT. This is very important because it basically shows how we was trying to create an interdependency between the judicial processes and the administration, and how the department and the OCJ are here to support the judicial process at the end of the day. And Chair, as we move forward later, this will also show how these processes are going to be harnessed by the whole policy move around the capacitation of the court administration environment and the OCJ repositioning process. The next slide looks into around the monitoring governance structures, which are cut across all the justice JCPS stakeholders. We've got the IJS three-tier committees, which cabinet has now been approved, and that three-tier entails at the higher level by the minister, which feeds to cabinet, and then at the OS strategic level is the DGs, which basically informs the operational levels. Then we've got the court optimization committee, which we have created under the court of directions led by the deputy minister, where we're getting all the stakeholders to participate and basically come to find ways of unblocking the challenges. We've got the ICT steering committee, which is the ISM led by the branch of my colleague, Ms. Mameja. Then we've got also the development committee of the JCPS cluster, which I chair, which also feeds the DG. These structures, Chair, they all put modernization at their center space. They ensure that every intervention, every resource utilization is basically geared to improve and enhance the modernization program across the justice value chain. Now, the IJS itself emanates from the National Crime Prevention Strategy of 1996, and as colleagues will know, they've been long in the gestation, and the program was further given impetus by the review of the criminal justice system, that's also by the National Development Plan of in 2012. And I think what we have managed to harness in this administration with the minister was bringing closer the interface between the ICJS and the IJS, which has been missing in the past. I think there have been a process which has led to concern that there have been investment in the IT infrastructure, but there was never any sense of an appreciation how that investment was leading towards efficiency. And I think ICJS are showing that kind of a direction. What is the efficiency drawn out of the investment that are drawn through the millions that are spent across the IJS? That table shows that all the government departments and the entities linked from the departments, which are part of the IJS transversal hub, the information sharing already every day as we speak, as we sit here, cascade and get transmitted across all those government departments. IJS key objective is to provide a hub where they can basically be a synergy and a seamless transfer of the information to ensure the efficiency of the IT. The road traffic agency basically are part of what is brought under the Department of Transport, while SASA comes under social development, and both departments are basically key stakeholders and participants in the JSPS cluster. And all the Legal Aid South Africa is part of this process. And as I indicate on the key priorities, I indicate areas where we've made some inroads around there. There are five key areas of integration around the ICT. One is the single person identifier. This one ensures that the very same person who enters the criminal justice system from the police must be the very same person who gets at the end of the value chain in terms of sentencing or rehabilitation, whatever, etc. As you know, and some of the examples which have come from the experience of the Marikana tragedy, many people, when they get arrested, they give wrong names. Some of the reasons why the delays in the payment of the Marikana victims is because the accused persons are known different from the names that appears in the ID. Now the CJS and the personal identity verification application is intended to use the fingerprint across the value chain as an identifier for every person, so that we are reliant not only on what people tell the police, but on what the basically IT reveals that person to be. The case management integration talks about the process spoken to, the registration of the case to the police, and how it gets channeled through the value chain up to the end of the justice value chain. And then we have used a kind of reporting dashboard. The reporting dashboard seeks to indicate at any given time where we are with the 28 KPIs, which were identified as objectives that should drive the ICT environment. And obviously, that we are also pursuing a single transversal database for the JCPS cluster, so that at the end of the day, the information that we are looking into basically talk to each other. And I think that will basically benefit and also cure some of the challenges we have around our data, the credibility of our data. That is basically the going down of this process under the IGIS. I can just indicate that those numbers indicate how many of the information on an ongoing basis get transmitted throughout the IGIS system. You can see that on the last bullet there, from April 2019 to date 2021, the solution successfully verified the identity of 421,913 persons, of which 213,713 had previous SAPC records, and 13,372 were identified as wanted persons. Through this system, we are able to verify any person arrested in any part of the country to be linked to any outstanding case anywhere in the province. And I think this is the value of the system. The SARS has been also very helpful in terms of social development, in terms of identifying people for purpose of grant application. And I think they've been able to verify even the correct identity to eliminate and reduce the opportunities for corruption. The integrated case flow, case man integration indicate that to date, from April 2021, 883,046 were electronically processed by the IGIS transversal hub. And that basically represents 834 police stations of the 101,157 existing countrywide data. We are still a process of ensuring that everything gets managed with data. And I think part of the biggest challenge and objective of the IGIS is to get everything into the ICT network. Thereafter, provide an adequate backup mechanism so that the issues of stolen information, stolen dockets, charge sheet missing, whatever, become the problem of the past. I'm talking about the legal aid. They also participate in supposed to electronic legal aid application. And this is the application because legal aid has got a very small footprint in terms of attorneys and justice centers. They have been able to manage an effective use of the system. And this team has also contributed to the legal aid kind of sustenance of that clean audit. And I think that's a matter that we're also emulating, although ours is quite a very vast platform. That one also gives a sense of how we move towards a paperless solution through the trials, whatever. What has happened over the few months since the outbreak of COVID in terms of virtual trials and how those have been piloted in the various courts, whatever. And I think this has also been built into IGIS so that those experiences which were imposed by COVID become the legacies of the IGIS project. We are not going to go back to where we come from, etc. The next slide, Chair, as I try to move quicker, indicates the data collection system framework across all the 28 KP performance indicators I've alluded to, and they are grouped into 16 key performance areas, and the green part indicates areas where there's already successful collation of information, data management across the value chain, while the amber indicate work in progress, and the red still indicate areas of a great challenge, which the IGIS project will basically seek to address. My colleague here, Mr. Nicholas Monyai, will then be able to articulate in the response to your members' question on a detail of what each and every key performance indicator seeks to achieve and what the project is doing to basically address those challenges. The next phase is very important. It talks to sexual offences interventions that we have introduced to the Sexual Offence Court. In 2015, South Africa was earmarked or identified as a country which must which must have a dedicated focus on the measures that should assist the world in addressing aspects of femicide. And part of the solution was to develop a dashboard through which we could basically be able to ascertain the extent of the femicide in this country, the extent of the interventions which are being impacted through this process, and also the effective use of the information gathered through the dashboard. This dashboard, Chair and honorable members, is basically our counterpart of the register. It enables us to be able to capture and to analyze information. It is not yet live because the past 3 years have been spent on designing the dashboard as part of the election system. And I think we are looking at the end of the third quarter of this financial year to put the dashboard on live, because the issue is that we don't want to put it on live when we are not sure that it's going to sustain the accuracy of the information that's going to be required and which is going to be accessed through by everyone, including international legislators. Now, I've talked about the challenges. As a wrap up, I've already indicated that most of the challenges are common across all the challenges. I think most of the obvious challenges, Chair, is the over-reliance on CETA. We all know what the CETA's challenges are. CETA in our sector represent the very same challenges of DPWI. Those are the services which create a lot of engagement between ourselves and the relevant department, and spend quite a lot of energy to try to harmonize and to find solutions across those systems. So the network connectivity and bandwidth still results in the slowness of the system. The Wi-Fi integration is very slow. There's a plea that we roll out the Wi-Fi, the fiber, as part of sustaining our system moving forward. And the capacity challenges are part of the challenges in terms of training, change management, especially around the use of the IT. And we still have the challenges from the NPA, for example, in terms of the use of the ECMS. But I and our colleagues, Advocate Dikok, were putting measures through the ICJS to come with the intervention. These are the part of the interventions we are looking into. Establishment of IJS CETA war room to protect procurement items, implementation of the IJS governance framework, which I've alluded to, and then the court optimization process, which the Deputy Minister is leading, and also the product plans, which we are designing to ensure that we are basically guided by strict timeframes to make sure that we are engaging these processes. More importantly, that we are able to liaise with the stakeholders within the judiciary in our efforts to harmonize our system. And as I conclude, Chair, Deputy Minister alluded to, every day we continue to get myriad of calls from challenges, systems break down in the courts and all. And us in the system, we believe that these challenges are basically one way of taking us up to come with better solutions to respond to our challenges. And we have the plans in place. We've got our heart in the right place. And I think what we need is just that turnaround moment where all these plans can basically yield the results we all want to see. And we are looking forward to that day, and we'll continue to work hard with our colleagues to make sure that we improve the space. Thank you, Honorable Chair, DG and Deputy Minister, and Honorable Members.
Thank you very much, Advocate Skosana. Is that the voice of the DM?
It was my voice, Chair.
Okay, Chair.
Yes, no, thank you very much, Chair. Just to say that we would have wanted it to be much shorter and straighter, but we thought we need to give you a full overview of what we are seized with. And also just to admit that what we are presenting may not necessarily be what pertains in practice as we speak now, the status quo. As many of you honorable members, you might even be getting calls from your different constituencies about the challenges that we experience in the courts. So part of what we have here is what we are seeking to achieve, what we think is ideal, but a bigger part of it as well is what we are convinced that we are working towards achieving something in a short space of time, and ultimately an ideal environment of a total modernized justice system. However, we are mindful of the real challenges on the ground, and we are seeking to address them. Thank you, Chair. This is our presentation.
Thank you very much, teacher. Members, do you want to interact with the presentation? I will see that through your raising hands. I have Honorable Horn, Honorable Brickenbach, Honorable Nivot Trachans, Honorable Janje, in that order. Honorable Horn, let me start with you.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to everybody on the platform. Chairperson, firstly, in respect of the modernization report, I must say that it is strange at best for us to be briefed that the implementation of basic tools like speed points are seen as a breakthrough in modernization in terms of court administration. I think at best it can be described as the department finally entering the new millennium, if one looks at matters like that. I've also taken note of the fact that issues around bandwidth, Wi-Fi, ICT infrastructure is throughout the presentation put forward as a reason for the fact that these systems are not fully functional at the moment. But yet, the question must be asked, I believe, from our side as part of our oversight, how can that perennially be put forward as part of the factors that impact on the effective implementation of new strategies? What is the plan then to ultimately fix it? The one thing we have all learned since March last year is that if you are forced into a situation to enable yourself to work on digital platforms and to improve your own ICT infrastructure, there are ways. But of course, it demands a bit of effort. Obviously, it will demand some form of dedicated budgetary provision. But I think the time has now come to ask of the department, what is your ultimate grand and master plan to effectively deal with this issue? Then, Chair, turning to the integrated criminal justice system presentation, if one takes into account, I think as the presentation itself says, that this was first conceptualized in 1996, and I think then after some planning, it kicked off towards 2007. Then I think we must say that on the face of what is presented here, we can breathe a sigh of relief that ultimately, for the first time, at least since I became a member of this committee in 2014, on what is being presented, there is some progress that is seen. So it's good to see that from 33 stations in the Western Cape, which was part of the pilot, now 72% of all police stations are involved throughout all of the 9 provinces. So let me appreciate the fact that we finally see some movement. I would think, however, for us, Chair, to have a proper oversight of how effective the system as it currently is are working, it is not simply good enough to tell us that 2% of all police stations are now linked. Maybe in reaction to the very last comments of the Director General, I think we must ask for a breakdown as to how constant and continuous this link to the system has been over the last maybe even just 3 months in respect of the 72% of stations. And in respect of these stations, what percentage of their dockets ultimately are uploaded onto the system? So it's all well and fine to say 72% of our stations are now linked, but if one considers the presentation and comments around the slowness of the system, IT and network challenges, then I think for us to get a clear picture of the efficacy of what is in place, we must ask, of these 72% stations, how percentage-wise, how many of their dockets are uploaded, and how many of them are uploaded in such a time frame that it ultimately enables the further departments in this value chain to make use of the information by the time, for example, accused first appears in court. Then also in respect of the cumulative cases, the 2.75 million cases processed from start to finish, or at least from docket to Department of Justice phase, it says cumulative, so a breakdown as to how many over the last number of years have been processed through the system, whether there is at least a proliferation in the number of cases, how many cases ultimately, in terms of the total number of cases before our courts are being dealt with via the system. Those types, that type of information, I think, can give us a better picture as to whether this system is nearing completion and full operation. And then on the issue of full operation, I think what we must ask as a follow-up is for the department, ultimately as the lead department in this thing, to give us a more detailed breakdown as to how it in its own analysis sees the progression and what the ultimate final target date is for full implementation. And then the last question I want to ask, and that's on the part of the presentation on the modernization led by the judiciary. I want to ask how much of a disruptor has this seemingly working in silos been in terms of the overall project plan? And to what extent has the initiative taken by the Office of the Chief Justice representing the judiciary being conceptualized, taking into account the work already done by the Department of Justice, or whether it is now a case of the OCG embarking on this process and now the Department of Justice is the lead department in terms of the integrated criminal justice system, having had to react to the initiatives of the Office of the Chief Justice. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me first agree with the Honorable Horn that there has been some small modicum of progress, for which I suppose we should be grateful, bearing in mind that this entire procedure is in its 24th year. It could have lived an entire life, gone through school and university, and already started a job. And here we are with some small progress, so yes, we should be grateful. But this whole integrated justice system has been plagued by delays and more delays and nothing but delays, and planning and more planning, and then meeting and discussing, and then piloting endlessly for 10 years at a time and achieving very little. And so the progress, while it is there, is certainly nothing to write home about. I worry that we're talking about the integrated justice system, that we're looking at issues of modernization and linking up electronically and finally moving the justice system into the 20th century while the rest of the world is in the 21st century. And yet we have courts like Messina that are falling apart, that have to be closed down because they present a danger to the people who are required to work there on a daily basis and the public who has to go there for service. The contradiction is stark. Where the toilet facilities that are available, this one toilet must be shared by staff, members of the public, everybody who comes there. It's a disgrace. So while we're talking about moving the Justice Department into the 20th century, in the 21st century we have courts that are being closed down because they're derelict. And I'd like to know how that happened before I even start with this integrated justice system. I find it unacceptable. It's been ongoing for years and nothing gets done. Just nothing gets done. It's inconceivable that an entire department, the size of the Department of Justice, cannot keep its court buildings up and running. And it's no good blaming public works. Somebody has to see to it that it happens, and it must be justice. Bearing that all in mind and looking at this presentation, I'd like to know whether the single person identifier across the criminal justice system has been implemented, and if so, can one example of it being successfully implemented please be given to us? And the current status of the interdepartmental infrastructure exchange process with the CJS, how far is that? Are they making progress? Has a single data store for the JCPS cluster been established? And if not, why not? Can the integrated justice system, has it been adapted to keep up with the current modernization and electronization of courts? Does it keep up with things like case lines? The National Prosecuting Authority has raised the following problem areas, identified the following risks, amongst others: a lack of integrated electronic case management. Has this been addressed, and if so, how? A lack of laptops and network connectivity, particularly in lower courts. Has this been addressed, and how? I heard the presentation of 4,000 laptops and 4,000 desktops, 8,000 being presented. 8,000 out of how many? How many people need to get laptops? How many people? I don't know what we're doing with desktops. I don't see the use of desktops. Who's getting desktops? Prosecutors certainly shouldn't be getting desktops. What they need is laptops. So 8,000 computers in the Department of Justice, out of how many? It means nothing to just say 8,000 computers. As compared to what? The Justice Annual Performance Plan of 2020-2021 and a revised integrated justice system governance structure was to have been approved by March 2021. The department now says that the governance structure will only be approved, implemented, and in full operation by the end of March 2024. What is the reason for this delay? Since 1997, it's 24 years. Our justice system has just been going backwards for 24 years. We don't keep up with the times. We don't keep up with modern developments. We don't keep up with the fourth industrial revolution that everyone loves to talk about. And we've got courts in the country that are falling on people's heads and they have to share one toilet from the entire community. 24 years. I mean, how is this possible? What is the Integrated Justice Board? How is it comprised of and what is its role? What's happened to the 7-point plan? Has it been implemented? Is it going to be implemented? And if so, when? In sort of our lifetime?
What has happened to the integrated task team on the criminal justice reform that was led by Lungi Mhlati? What happened to that? Lungi's retired. Is this thing retired with him? Does it exist? If it does exist, what is it doing? Why don't we hear what it's doing? What has happened to the integrated justice system report that was supposed to be due in 2018? And why hasn't this committee received a copy? And if it exists, can we please get a copy? I'd like to read it. And I hear the reliance now being placed on fingerprints to identify people across the system.
Sorry, Honorable Breitenbach.
Yes.
Copy of? I'm just waiting. Which copy are you talking about?
It's the Integrated Justice System. I can't read my own handwriting. Integrated Justice Something report that was due in 2018. I'll get it for you. I'll give it to you later. I'll find it.
Okay.
In terms of slide 28 of this presentation, it's a very pretty picture. But how many cases have been finalized successfully in terms of this dashboard? Just one. Can you just demonstrate one case that has been finalized successfully in terms of this dashboard? From the start to the end. I have many, many other issues to raise, but let my colleagues do it. I see their many hands up. Thank you.
Thank you. You can come for the second bite if you want to. Honorable Leibold Schachen.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to the department for the presentation. I would like to start with slide 5. The modernization roadmap, where it says, I see there, I see the yellow there, but you said that there are circles. Now, the circles there, I want to know what has been completed, because as you say, it's completed up to August 2020. Is it August 2021 or completed up to July 2021? Because the circles are only on the left-hand side, but the rest, you know, doesn't really tell us what has been completed. And if you say it's completed, it looks like it's the whole thing up to the month of, you know, 2021. I'm not clear what has been completed. That's slide 5. Now, slide 19, the hub, the orange, the two orange arrows is for correctional services. I'd like to focus on this. It means that it's testing. The orange says that it's currently testing. Now, I would like to ask, what is being tested? Because the reason why I'm asking is the person who spoke first said that we would like to bring ICT closer or to the people, closer to the people, would like to bring that, which is all well and great, but using this example, and you said from steps up until the end, so for example, I've been to SAPS in my constituency in Swartland. Now, I think it was Darling, and we visited the SAPS, and one of the complaints came from a councillor there who said that a person who is released from prison, the person was released on parole, but the community and the victims didn't know that the person was being released. So then I mean, SEPs, then people go to complain at SEPs, but they are only the contact point. But the victims were not informed, and the community and the family doesn't know that this dangerous criminal has been released. Now, SEP says it has nothing to do with them. It's not their responsibility. And then they point to correctional services because they say it's their responsibility. But the public does not have access to correctional services. And the public doesn't have access to go to court, you know, demanding to know why the person was released without the victim and the victim's family and the community knowing that that person has been released. Now, with the ICJ-RJS, the system, the integration of the system, SAPS will know that that person has been released and then notify the victim. SAPS should be part of the system to inform the public, but I don't see that there is a link where the victims or the public, you know, is informed. Like you say, the case goes from SAPS to and then into correctional services, but how does that end up in the public space where the public can see, you know, or know? I see correctional services in the hub is still being tested, but what does that mean? And how is this done? Is it before a person is released? You know, does the public, especially with regards to, you know, if even counselors, they should know so that we can tell the victims and their family. But the ICT here, I'm not clear how this works in this scenario, in this kind of scenario. And I think that was my last question. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Voortdrachten. Honorable Swart.
I thought I was before him.
Yes, no, my apologies.
You're correct, Chair.
Yes, no, my apologies. Honorable Janji.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief, Chair, because after speaking to the other members, after speaking after them, they have really covered comprehensive areas, so that allows me to just raise very brief issues, Chair. I would not want to repeat what they've said because I think I am in support of the issues. Just in three areas that I want to focus on, perhaps just four, Chair, very briefly. The first one, Chair, is on the modernization. I think it would have been better, DG, and at DM to have titled that slide, it is not modernization progress. This is modernization planning progress. What you have presented here is a plan, basically. I really want to get into that because in the entirety of that, there's a sense of action. It is in what they call pilot. They're piloting this, they're piloting that. So then nothing has started really. And in fact, even the pilots, majority of them would be in Pretoria, head office and all of that. I think it's only fair that perhaps you indicate, because even those pilots, I don't think that one is even happy about those. It might be good, Chair, that I don't know at what point, not necessarily this term, so they come back with us where we deal with progress, not the planning that we're presenting here. I would like us to do that. The other way it would have to have those things reflected in the annual performance plans and all of those kind of things. Otherwise, we'll be wasting our time with some kind of theory here. And I don't want us to do that. The second point within that first point is, I think it's a culture issue, because the person presenting was saying that they also have an idea about risk and mitigation measures. That can't be an idea. The culture is anything you plan that has got public resources,
has got to have these risk and mitigation measures, because this is about how you manage resources, how you're going to manage the performance. So it can be almost like an afterthought. I'm not interested in that being called an idea. In the sixth administration, at least from this committee, we've been very consistent on that line, that everything you bring to us, you've got to demonstrate what are those kind of, in other words, we're interested in the risk page all the time. And then they have, let me leave that, on the courts issues, Mr. Skosana said they prioritize Gauteng, KZN, and Western Cape in relation to the taxi here and then unrest issues. I'm just not sure, Chair, whether that is in line with the demand in terms of where the major challenges are, because you might have challenges in your Eastern Cape, which is most rural, or Limpopo, for example, in terms of the courts. And when you focus on these two major urban provinces, Gauteng and Western Cape and KZN, I don't know to what extent you're taking away that attention to the other provinces that, in terms of the court system, from where I'm sitting, I know they're lagging behind in quite a number of things. So whilst one welcomes that kind of focus, I'm worried about unintended consequences in that regard. Again, a lot of the worrying issues here, because which is part of the planning of this modernization. You and Honorable Horn made the point about the speed pay points. I come from the Magistrate Commission that I represent, I send to. That institution, Chair, does not have a Wi-Fi. If you go there, there's no Wi-Fi. And so one will be interested in the unpacking of these kind of things. And at what point is this? That's why I'm calling it plan. These are plans, because one has not seen. And perhaps they can assist us as to, beyond the pilots, when are these things going to be taken into action? My last point here is on the IJS. The only point here, which I want to make, it is in line with what Honorable Breitenbach was raising. This is one of the blind spots we must be attentive to. We are missing, because I think we did it once, in committee room one in the 120 building. The issue here is for us to have these annual reports. And I guess that's what Honorable Breitenbach was looking for. Because all of these things that they said are happening here, the best platform for us to assess that will be out of that report. So that we're not doing things ad hoc and dealing with anecdotes. We have not done that in 2020. We did it almost in an unplanned way in 2019, and I don't remember us doing it last year. So I will be interested that's a report that we must not miss in 2021 as we go forward. Those are my just brief points I wanted to raise here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You said the name of the report that we must not miss is what? You are muted.
On this integrated justice system report, I think we did it in 2019, and it was kind of a once-off thing, and we never followed that up.
Okay, thank you very much. Honorable Jale.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me welcome the presentation and also greet the Deputy Minister and the DG, the team. Chairperson, I think my colleagues have covered me so much that they made me realize that we have a colleagues that are coming from far from with these issues, dating back from 2006, 2007, with those seven point plan, those which would be some of the key issues which were kind of the foundation of where we are today. There are a lot of questions or clarity questions that I wanted to find out from our department, but I'm covered in most of the cases, Chairperson. But just to emphasize on the issue of this one of 7 points, plan, I wanted to find out how much is this presentation or the progress that we have today covers those issues on the 7-point plan. But realizing that, yes, according to the report that we get and also reading on these issues, there is a progress, but as our colleagues who come from afar with this reporting to us that it's not much of any progress. But to us, for now, we would appreciate their report. But on the issue of modernization, Chairperson, I'm covered also on the issue of the remote areas. But I still want to emphasize that the department, for the department to be able to realize that indeed we are making a progress on this, I think they have to consider those courts in the remote areas should be their point of departure. Because when you talk about Pretoria, Johannesburg, you are not saying anything when it comes to this issue of modernization, because those areas, they are already empowered, Chairperson. We're talking about those remote areas, as my colleague just mentioned. I wanted to emphasize that issue also, that can next time when they come, their point of departures or their example that they wanted to use as the areas of where they are doing implementing this modernization should be in those remote areas, so that we can be able to see exactly what are the problems that we are facing. And then lastly, Chairperson, that I would want also to emphasize is it is on the issue of the integration. These other departments that we are mentioning here, much as our department is doing progress on this, we are hearing the report from them that indeed the progress is the integrated one. But I don't know how Chairperson would be able to get the report also from these other departments, which is the true reflection, that we would know exactly that even in those departments, they don't have problems. Because if we are identifying such problems in our department, what more with them? Because it will be useless for us to go on and get those reports, and at the end we find that we get the report where the department will say, you know, we were really moving with this project, but unfortunately we realized later that what we were getting in our meetings, the reports that we're getting when you go to the actual places, it's not like that. So, Chairperson, I would pause at this place. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jelle. Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to leave my camera off just due to the connectivity. And as my colleagues have indicated, a lot has already been said, and I associate myself with some of the deep concerns that have been expressed about the state of our courts. Yes, we look at modernization, we look at the ICJS, we look at the integrated systems, but over many, many years, we do see some progress, but obviously the progress is far too slow. I would like to more details about the cooperation between SAPS, courts, the NPA, when it comes to modernization, when it comes to the IT systems speaking to one another. And that has always been the biggest challenge. And yes, Advocates Kosana did point out that he has to deal daily with IT maintenance, with systems being down. I think that is a major problem also with SAPS. And I think that this does lead to problems, does lead to problems with managing awaiting trial detainees, court processes. So we might need to look into this with more detail. The other issue that I am quite interested in, and that is the issue relating to the masters and deceased estates online portals that is now, that has been announced or has been improved, because I was always under the impression that this was in existence way back from the days of the Master Basson, Advocate Lester Basson, who announced online registrations. So I'd like more clarity. We were led to believe the system was already operative. Is it now just an improvement for the that is referred to in the documentation, the e-channel for the registration of deceased estate cases? If it is so, then it's a concern that there's now only a pilot project, because I was under the impression that this was already in operation. Then one looks further at modernization, and we are aware of the judiciary's report, the Chief Justice's report, the Office of the Chief Justice were pressed about the modernization and the challenges. Obviously, we appreciate our budgetary constraints, and we need to accept responsibility for that, DG and Deputy Minister. But I do think I'd like an update on progress. We hear of case lines that is doing very well in Gauteng, but progress in criminal and civil trials that can be done virtually, and that required an amendment of the rules of court. Has that gone through? Is that in the process? Because we see, due to COVID-19, that the court roles are backing up, and one would have thought that there would be more progress in that regard, although it's not strictly on the ICJS, it's part of modernization. Maybe we can just touch on that. Thank you, Chair. That's all from my side.
Thank you very much, Honorable Pettenbach.
I'm covered. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The report that I wanted was, just a moment, the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation Integrated Justice System Assessment Report.
Okay. Thank you very much. Deputy Minister, as a direct question to you, this issue of the integrated justice system, does it form part of the performance agreement between the minister and the president?
Chair, thanks. I'm not 100% sure of that one. Maybe the DG would know. So if he could also attend to that. Let me just say that I think the department needs to respond to the issues raised. I think they have been crucial issues that have been raised by the members. The officials will know that some of those issues and others I've been raising with them on the issue. Problems like commitments being made to regional court presidents relating to repairs, and those commitments then not being met. I think it would be useful for the department, for the committee, portfolio committee, to continue to monitor the implementation of this report on a regular basis. Thanks, Chair. Chair, I've also got to leave at 12:30. I don't know if you'll be finished by then.
Okay. No, that's fine. And then, is there any political champion for this project?
Chair, I'm not the, I mean, it's the minister and I'm not the political champion for this. I'm not sure if the minister is able to directly attend to it again. I think the DG should speak to that.
Then, DG, this project was started in 1997, and at that time, there was partnership with Business Against Crime. Do you still have that partnership?
Thanks, Chair. I think the colleagues who have been longer in the department than me, but so far in my interaction for the time that we have been in the department the past 2 years, even in another formation, we have not really had that regular interaction with the Business Against Crime. And the program itself, I think the IJS has had some challenges, particularly even in relation to staffing. It has mainly been managed on the basis of contracts in the department. But I know that, like as you know yourself, historically the Business Against Crime was a critical stakeholder. But it's part of what we are doing now to get the program back again on its feet. I think we will take that as well as part of a contribution that we need to engage with Business Against Crime. Now, the IJS indeed forms part, Chairperson, of the Minister's Performance Agreement with the President. And in relation to the political champion, the Minister is, because they are just these key departments that have to be coordinated even at the ministerial level. So the reform of the governance structure of the IJS speaks to that, the coordination of the ministers, and which the minister has to chair and link up with the JCPS cluster ministerial meetings. And we are hoping that that structure as well to provide a political oversight over accounting officers, which we have to coordinate in the justice value chain system. We may not in the past 6 to 12 months have been in our best, but the whole idea of the commitment to reform the governance structure is to make sure that you have the committee of ministers, mainly those key ministers, SAPS, Home Affairs, Social Development, and DOJ, CD, becoming the political principals in the cluster broadly and in government.
And then how many of your project managers have a project management background who are managing this project?
I must say, Chair, that we had a challenge that the project itself was being managed by contracted project managers. And we have just finalized a structure that will be a project management, but based in the department. And by before the end of this month, we are hoping to have appointed a head of the IJS itself. And from the advert that was done, project management skill and experience was a critical requirement. So the person that will be appointed to head the project by end of this month will be skilled and experienced in the area of project management. And then consequently, the other people that will join that team to assist the person will also have to have strong project management background. I think my line is disconnected. Either it's a chair that disconnected, so I might still be online, yeah.
I think it is the chair, Mr. Moshabane.
Thank you. Yeah, that's my answer. I don't know whether then we wait for the chair will be guided by the honourable members, or whether we can proceed and deal with the other questions.
Could the secretariat perhaps check if the chair is going to connect or is connecting? That's from Honourable Woman Ewart Griffin.
We are on it, ma'am. We're on it. Come back to just now. The chairperson is experiencing load shedding on that side. I just spoke with him now. He's trying to reconnect with his phone.
Members, I'm not a member of this committee, as you know, but while the chair is trying to join, should maybe the whip not be asked to chair? I see he's joined now, the chair.
I'm glad. No, thank you very much. It was ESCOM issues. Can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Okay. Okay. No, I think we had electricity problem this side. DJ, you are still answering?
Yes, I'm not sure to what extent you managed to hear the last part of my response. But I was saying the person that will be appointed end of this month to be the head of the project for a 5-year period was required to have strong project management background, and the other team of about 6 to 8 that will be joining that person. The requirements as well will also include the project management skills in the area of IT.
And then in the 24 years since you have been using contracts, in fact, outside contractors, how much have you spent on outside contractors?
I don't have figures with me here, but I can try and get that information even before the end of this session. But surely it should be a lot of money, because the project has predominantly been managed by contractors. That seemed to have been the approach that was adopted then. And also that from 1997, at some point, the project was with the SAPS, And I'm advised that I think around 2011, the part of the program then was brought to the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. And there's still a part of it, which remains with the SAPS. So from that budget. So what we'll try to do as well generally is to get a sense of the past 20 years of what has happened to this far. I think with the request for report from honorable members, I think that will help as well that all of us will come to the same page in terms of the history of this project and how far we have made progress, and but also looking at the expenditure. Because as we try now to make sure that there's a rapid implementation, I think it will be very important that we get a sense of what has transpired, including the report from the Department of Planning and Monitoring and Evaluation. I think that will form part of the information that we need to bring here, that we all of us be on the same page.
So as the accounting officer, because when I read the report last night, even our research document, something in the range of about 2 billion has been spent. Do you think that the contractors that we have been paying, or we have been paying as the state over the years, there was value for money?
Look, I might be speaking from a vantage point of where we are now, and as they say, the rear mirror is always clearer than the windshield. I don't think literally I can say that there was a value for money, but I think the report that we want to do, some form of a compilation of a report and auditing of the entire program will give us a sense. But I'm not convinced on the basis of the status quo that that investment has really put us where we're supposed to be. As you will have heard from the honorable members as well, talking about the fact that we are just now trying to get into the 20th century when everyone is in the 21st century. But you can see there was the wisdom of the political leadership of this country that by that time they could invest in a program like this. And I think had we been lucky with implementation, we would have been very far as a country.
Okay, so you can proceed with the other questions, responses to the other questions.
Okay, I'll request the acting CIO, Mr. Hentin Kurtz, to deal with the first batch of questions, and the second ones that relate mainly to the IJS, I'll request Mr. Nicholas Munyai to deal with them, and Advocate Kosana will come back and try to synthesize the ones that are related to the courts. And the judiciary and the OCJ. Thank you, Chair Hentin.
Thank you, DG. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members. I'm going to try and deal with them in sequence. The first question was around how the department is moving into the 20th century, whereas we're supposed to be looking at the 21st as well as the implications of why. And from where I'm sitting, I certainly agree with that. One of the honorable members has mentioned that perhaps we should be grateful about the little progress. I'm not saying we should do that. I'm saying change takes time. And the change is a little bit more complex than just moving from paper-based processes to electronic cash transfers. Be that as it may, the good thing is that the pandemic has forced us to come up with a different thinking in terms of how we deal with change, and it also has accelerated the need for transformation. However, in order for us to modernize, we need to first stabilize. I'm a firm believer that we can't just jump from the first step up until the 10th step in terms of a modernization journey. That's why a lot of what we are focusing on now is to stabilizing the environment, which will allow the smooth running of the modernization efforts. There's already...
Mr. Hanson, but that, We were expecting that maybe in 1998, 99, 2000, not now. I mean, your response is really insulting to the community. To tell us after 24 years that no, we must be grateful to the...
Thank you, Chair.
You are insulting us.
My apologies for that, Chair, but I think I'm dealing with not the IJS issue. And the modernization journey, as far as our infrastructure, is not necessarily that long a process. But I apologize if I am insulting any of the honorable members. That's not the intention. I'm trying to just explain the rationale behind where we are right now in terms of where we as the IT fraternity for the Justice Department want to move the modernization. Having said that, because of all these the issues that we are having, we are making a concerted effort, and there had been what I have not reported is, and I think I've touched on the network issues. We have already started with in the last financial year and in this financial year with regards to upgrading all our infrastructure. So there's a lot of other technical things that are happening in the last two financial years that I'm not necessarily bringing up. But there's a saying that say we need to plan for the future while we actually run the current. So for us, as far as speed points are concerned, that is the first step. And it is reliant on us having an effective and efficient infrastructure and operations environment. And that's the plan that we are putting forth here. That is the first question there. Then the next question that deals with the laptops and desktops, had that been presented? What is the use of desktops out of how many? So at the moment, we've had, like I was indicating during the presentation, it is a rolling target. As we are replacing old desktops, there are within the space of a year older desktops that are getting end of life, or not desktops, laptops and desktops going end of life and need to be replaced. But at the moment, we are replacing 8,000 out of 16,000. In the last financial year, we have replaced 3,000 laptops. We are replacing another 4,000, which bring it to 7,000 laptops. And the other 4,000 desktops is there are areas within our environment that currently are using, like the pay points, the only use desktops for that purposes. That might change over time, but the bigger driver for now in terms of our strategy for laptops versus desktop is the cost containment, because the desktops are much cheaper than the laptops, and also the requirement for mobility. Not necessarily, like for instance, at the service points, the people are not necessarily mobile at the moment, and for that reason, there still is desktops. There's also spaces in the development environment where we need powerful desktops to run testing. So there are pockets where we still use desktops. But the number that we're looking for is out of 16,000. The next question that I've noted here for myself is on slide 5, the modernization roadmap. I apologize when I presented it, and I'm apologizing again. I noticed that the coloring is a bit confusing, especially the orange. On the areas, the dots that are green are the ones that are actually completed. So for deceased estates, trust online, expungement, and civil, the first block is development. Development had been completed. Whereas on the CAFs, the tender specification had been completed. Then everything else, the next block after the green block is orange. There's an orange dot there that most people can't see. But maintenance online, for instance, it's in progress, which is an orange dot, is in pilot phase. Deceased estates is testing is in progress, which is the next block. Trust testing, expungement testing, civil online testing. Protection orders, the first block is development. We are busy with the development there. It's in progress.
and then the NRSO, the same, the first block development, we are busy with that. And then on the last one, CAFS, the tender publication is currently under process. So there's an orange block there as well. Then one of the honorable members, I think Honorable Gianti has mentioned that this is the specific slide, slide 5, is more around planning. And it's true, but we try to encapsulate both the plan as well as the progress in there. And I agree with the sense that say that we need to provide the explicit process. That's what we try to do. But also these specific projects are managed currently as part of our APP, as was mentioned by the honorable member as well. Then I think I've spoken to the speed points and Wi-Fi. It needs to be unpacked. And the risk flight. So there was also mentioned right about the risk flight. I agree fully with that. In the beginning, the DJ has apologized for us submitting late. And part of that was because we were reviewing the slides and adding specifically the risk and the issues to the presentation. But from our perspective, we are constantly looking at the risks as it pertains to specifically our modernization project, but everything else as well. For us, we're looking at it at least on a weekly, monthly basis, and then devising means in terms of how to address these risks continuously. But perhaps in the next presentation, as was a request from one of the honorable members, we will bring it much more to the fore as well, the risk slide, so that we can actually give a presentation around that as well as how we are dealing with it. Then, the honorable member, Honorable Swart, has mentioned the last one that I think I need to respond to. The Masters and Deceased online portals, more clarity is required there. Indeed, we can provide more clarity. But the part where I want to agree first is the Masters portal had been online for a long time now. The only difference now is what we are doing currently is traditionally the Masters portal had been there for searching, predominantly searching for trusts and deceased estate cases, and being able to download the letter of appointment and the J87 query sheet as well. What we are now doing here is we are evolving. In the next phase is to look at how do we allow for transacting. The first part of the transaction would be the user should be able to capture their registration details for deceased estates and trusts, as well as attach the relevant supporting documents like IDs, the trust deed, the death certificates, etc. And then we also want them to capture cases. The capture cases is then sent to the ICMS. That's where the integration we now need to devise the integration there as well for the clerk to review and approve the request or request additional information on the application based on the information that was captured. And once everything is verified, the application is then approved in ICMS and processed by the Master's Office. So it's more taking the application to the next step. I think those were the five side questions specifically for modernization. Thank you, Chair.
Mm-hmm. Nicholas Nyai, Chairperson, with your permission.
Thanks, DG, and the Honorable Chair of the Portfolio Committee and Honorable Members of the Justice and Correctional Services Portfolio Committee. The question which we raised first was by Honorable Horn with regard to the 72% of the case, the 72% that we have referred to in the report is on the utilization of the PIVA services by police stations, not on the case flow process that is done through investigate case docket management system and CAS. It's on the number of police stations where PIVA has been rolled out in those police stations, which is amount to 72%. It's not necessarily the case flow processes. The slide that spoke around the case flow is the one that talks about the number of cases that have been captured and gone through the IGS transversal hub, ECMS, ICMS. That is around 2.7 million. That is indicated from 2016. The one should first also acknowledge that over time with the program, there's been case management system developed, and by now we're sitting with almost all 8 member departments of the IJS, police, DOJ, legal aid, Office of Chief Justice, social development, having the case management system. And I think when that opportunity arises to send a progress report, we'll then be able to break down even yearly or monthly how the cases are flowing through this integrated case management flow. And I think one would then have to acknowledge that, of course, the SAPS still, while we've been implementing the investigate case docket management system with the aim of replacing the old CAS, but they are still using two systems for that arrangement while they finalize the enhancement of the case investigate case docket management system. And the Honorable Breitenbach raises the issues of delays with the progress, which we also acknowledge. But I think the new governance framework seeks to address some of these challenges that the program has faced. And the colleague would remember that there have been several reviews of the IJS. There was a Mumedi report which emphasized on the need to have an IJS transversal hub and ensure that there's information flow across all member departments. And secondly, 2011, there was another review, which then that review recommended that in the IJS board, it should not only be ICT heads who sit in the board, but also business representatives. And lastly, the report that Honorable Breitenbach is referring to, which is the DPME report, which currently, as IJS, we are also responding to all those 13 findings that have been made by the DPME. So the governance framework on its own, we are now, it has been approved, we are now in the process of implementing that framework. Already, what used to be the IJS board is no longer the IJS board, it's IJS implementation committee. And that committee will be reporting to the IJS Board of DGs, and ultimately with the political champion being the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services. What has been a challenge was that much as the program, the IJS program, is within the DOJ and constitutional development, but member departments were not necessarily accounting to the program itself or to the IJS, the then IJS board, which is now IJS implementation committee. So whatever happens in those departments, they will then account to their respective departments, and you will not have a consolidated approach of dealing with all the even the change requests and all the escalations that will be coming from the implementation committee. So that is going to assist us in that. And the mere fact that all the achievements, little as they may be, accrued to member departments would not necessarily be reflecting on the work that IJS has done. And again, there was a question on the issue of single person identifier. You'd recall now, colleagues, that there is a project that IJS, together with CETA and SAPS, are deploying is what we call integrated person management project. And the issue of the single person identifier is part of the deliverables of that huge project, which was supposed to be started in 2013. But again, on the issue that you say NPA would also be complaining over them not having devices and all that, what we have done as the IJS implementation committee, it was then board, it took a resolution that NPA prosecutors were complaining that they do not have necessary devices to be able to use the ECMS system for the case flow processes that normally comes from the investigate case docket management. And as I guess, it was in 2019 where around 3,500 laptops were purchased for the prosecutors. And to date, this matter of lack of the low utilization rate of this ECMS by prosecutor is an agenda, standing agenda item of the IJS implementation committee. There was a survey, that survey was presented. There's a lot of intervention that needs to go in as much as change management is concerned. Because previously we thought that the issue is mainly because prosecutors does not have adequate devices to be able to process cases through the electronic case management system. But it seems that the problem is much bigger than that, or the change management intervention that we have to then provide as the IJS. And I think the other question that is being raised, that was raised, I think the DG also responded on the issue of the governance framework. But there was a question as it pertains to connectivity issues. And I think boldly, as the IJS implementation committee, which is composed of all those 8 member departments in the criminal justice system, there is a general understanding that we need to find a common approach in how we deal with the issue of the infrastructure. And we have, through the implementation committee, been also engaging the CENTEC to see what is it that can be done with regard to their digital infrastructure services, while there's over-reliance on CETA. And I don't want to then deal. We have even established what we call the CETA war room to deal specifically with all these challenges that member departments are facing in as much as connectivity is concerned. But we are also looking at various options outside CETA, like I've said, that we are also engaging the CENTEC to look at the broader approach of assisting all member departments. Because one of the problems that NPA also complained about was that in the case flow process that will start from SAPS, the problem that we face is that some of the capturing of the docket process would be incomplete and make it very difficult for NPA prosecutors who do it through clerks to be able then to effect changes in that process. And we've identified 10 police stations across the country, those with high volume of cases. And we've been to Sunnyside police stations to observe the utilization of PIVA and also the case flow process from investigate case docket management system and CASE. And we did pick that those who are capturing, also there's the change management issue. They are also not trained, which we are dealing with police. They have to learn at a go in how this capturing process ought to be. Those are things that we are working with police to ensure that we deal with that problem. Well, there was a question on the DCS. Look, I think in the presentation it indicated GEL. One can then confirm that DCS is connected, and DCS and DOJ are finalizing some business processes that are relating to J7. So the DCS received electronic J7 form from DOJ through the hub, and they utilize the person identity profile through IJS Hub. Of course, they still need to finalize that business process part. And the DCS provide data to IJS for BI purposes, business intelligence purposes. So it's only that component of the J7 that will have the finalization of that business process relating to J7. But all in all, it is connected. There was a question, or one would say it's a comment from Honorable Swart around the utilization of Case Line, which is the IJS project in OCJ, which was piloted in Pretoria and Johannesburg High Court. And there was a, at the time, I think the first quarter of last financial year, there was a move where the Supreme Court of Appeal and other high court felt that it was necessary for them to also start using Case Line. But the issue which was there was that the Case Line is the second part of the end-to-end system, which is caught online, which the first part has to be the case management system itself, which is Microsoft CRM Dynamics. And then the second part, the Case Line, is evidence-based management for the uploading of the bundles and all that. And I can safely report that that component, the first part of the CRM Dynamics, has now been completed. We are currently doing the user acceptance testing, and the pilot is also planned from September in the Pretoria and Joburg High Court, so that when we move to other to Supreme Court of Appeal and other high courts, then we move with a full end-to-end court online system. I think the other issue, the chair raised an issue around the relationship with the business against crime. It was part of the IJS transversal hub, but in 2019, due to some contractual issues with the Department of Police, they opted out of the transversal hub, but were still manageable to engage them to bring them on board chair. And I think all in all, one could say that there's been a case management system across all member departments. What has been a missing link is the integrated person management part, which there's a lot of focus now being paid on the SAP's integrated person management system. The IJS program, like the DG said, was in SAP's for some time, and the department, when it was brought, it was only the PMO part which was brought here. And then the transversal, which is the core of the IJS, only came to be part of the DOJ, to be frank, I think 2016. But we've been finalizing the governance arrangement so that there's a single synergy as it pertains to the IJS program. Because you would always have a problem if one IJS-related project is not moving at the pace or as per the plan, but you would have little influence on what then do you enforce to TMS of police to say the project is delaying, it's critical, if the police is the nuclear of the criminal justice system. So if projects are delaying at that level, we needed something to be able to cushion and have a frame under which we can be able to work, and there can be a single point of accountability, hence the new governance framework that that has been approved by the minister, and we are in the process of implementing it. I want to check if I still have another, if I've missed. So, just to state that the DPME report, that review, which produced the report in 2018. That report is there. We'll also be able to furnish it to members of Parliament. And we are in the process of implementing those 13 recommendations, and they are part of the DOJ APP. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, with your permission, may I request Advocate Kosana to wrap up the remainder of the questions?
Thank you, Chair. I'll move with some speech. Let me start with the question from Honourable Horn, who asked whether the silos in respect of the DOJ and OCJ was disruptive and causing some delay in the process. I must just say the structures and the teams that I've mentioned are basically geared towards improving integration.
Can you check presentation number for John? I might well be delayed.
Sorry, did you? Okay. Yes. So I must say that those structures I've mentioned between us and OCJ at judicial level as well as at OCJ level are bearing fruit, and I think although not extend that to the 1-2, but the engagement, the meeting, justice still holds the major the bulk of the budget around the ICJS and accounting for those funds, and I think OCJ is a willing and able partner in the process, and I think I must just indicate that Honourable Breitenbach has raised quite a number of questions, but the most important is the one which relates to the modernization vis-à-vis the facilities infrastructure, and I cannot even want to defend ourselves. I think the DG since has come on board where has been knocking at the door of public works and infrastructure. DM has been knocking on the doors, and I think we are now in the process of establishing a broad framework, which through it we simply now request that we be devolved to information that we can run ourselves. We believe that if we are given maintenance and let them remain with the construction of new buildings, whatever, it will take us a long way to do so. We are with the stakeholders in the courts. We know what must happen, and I think we become paralyzed and discredited just for us to be unable to respond to the issue of the ground. And I think we've basically agreed that that framework should find its way to the highest level of governance at the ministerial level if we are not making headway at the level of the GGs. And I think we've formulated the framework, and I think once this kind of presentation will come and share with the honourable members, because I think we do need even the political support and process. The most important thing, I think DJ put me on the spot, that some of the oldest employees may know what had happened to IJS, and the most important part is the 7-point plan with Honourable President Baka Brace. 7-point plan was basically seven principles which would have transformed the criminal justice system. And I think the IJS constitutes two of those 7 plans. And I think it's plan number 5 and plan number 6. But the others relates to the whole issue of the common vision across the value chain, the issue of capacitation of the value chain, the issue of the stakeholder engagement, the issue of the civilian participants, etc. And I think what emerged immediately, I was appointed court services in 2016. It emerged that although the 7-point plan was a very ambitious and vibrant program to take to transform the criminal justice system, it was not accompanied by any form of strategy or operational plan against which the whole system would be measured. And so departments started to run the programs in the silo mentality, and others started to spend money, and lots of amounts were lost in corruption, the DCS, and which are basically public knowledge. It's only in 2018 that was agreed that the ICJS, which is an integrated justice strategy, be a plan to pull together all those 7-point plan. Now, there are two fundamental decisions around the ICJS. One is to conduct an evaluation of how far have we come in terms of the 7-point plan since 2007-2008. That process is still at the DG's level, and I think it's led by DOJ. So we are doing, and we believe that plan, that assessment must be done outside the system, because departments themselves, all of us, we believe we are working and we are becoming defensive in this approach. But we believe that if we're going to get an independent process to evaluate the seven point plan against what had happened, it will basically augment the plan which was internal. The plan which was done by DPMU, was basically internal focused, which my colleague intended to be shared the portfolio committee. And I think it was identified at the current level. We need a broader plan that will look into the issue of efficiencies and issues of value for money. And I think in terms of reference points have been determined, and I think the DGs have endorsed terms of reference, and I think we're in a process where we are ready to seek a kind of partnering arrangement with either HRC or whoever in the space who can do that quick assessment. Based on that outcome, we'll then be able to start engaging with the leftovers. And we'll also appreciate what is the value of what they've been spent in the process over these years, etc. That's the first arm of the ICJS. The second arm, which the minister decided it must go to the Law Reform Commission, seeks to deal with the Criminal Justice Reform process that seeks to transform the Criminal Procedure Act. And I think they were also engaging with the Law Reform Commission. There's a meeting scheduled for this Friday, where I'll be speaking to the chairperson of the Law Reform Commission in terms of what expectations are from the department side around those aspects. So that's the broad concept of the ICJ, of the 7-point plan, and how it fits into the ICJS. I think the review, Advocate Masachi was appointed to lead the process of the review of the 7-point plan, which we have now came to realize that it would be better and ideal that it have an independent outlook and assessment from outside. And I think that report will guide everybody in terms of how much was spent and how much that was have been formed, the transformation objectives. Honorable Chan Chief raised raised the concern that what I've explained in terms of the case at M. Gauteng Western Cape may take the focus out of all the provinces. I apologize if I put it in that fashion. What I intend to say is not that we are taking our eyes out of the other provinces. I was saying that the meetings arrangements which were put into space between ourselves, DCS, subs, etc., which integration was imposed by the recent unrest-related incidents in KZN and other and Western Cape, etc., and also the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, have given us the leverage to engage and use those provinces as a focal point to harness whatever we're doing in other provinces. So it does not mean that we're putting our foot off the brake in terms of the Eastern Cape and Northern Cape, etc. But what we're saying, because we're now engaging daily, we're now looking at the numbers as a trickle in. We're now coming with the interventions on the spot in terms of those provinces. We're using the lessons from that engagement to impact on the other processes in other provinces. The next was, I think I've covered aspects raised by Honorable Chair around the 7-point plan. And I think until we have done the complete assessment, we will then, once it is done, we'll then be able to say with confidence that these are aspects we have been covered and dealt with from the 7-point plan. These 6 points are still missing, but these 4 are half-baked. And I think this is going to assist us moving forward. Honorable Swart have raised the issue of the cooperation between ourselves, SAPS and NPA. And I think within the ICJS, there's the greater cooperation. And I think what may become important in some time to come is to get an integrated presentation by all participants of the JCPS, so that we can present the ICJS to extended covers all departments moving forward, etc. These are the points which have been raised largely, and I think if there's any other thing in DG which I've missed out, I'm glad to come and share some viewpoints on it. Thank you, Honorable Chair, for the opportunity, and thanks for honorable members.
Mm-hmm.
Are we done, DJ and DM?
Yes, yes. I think we have covered in the main the questions. Just maybe the information that I have now on Messina, which was raised. I know that was not necessarily the main question, but that we are back to operation. They are just finalizing some few related maintenance work there, and at least also to just confirm to this committee that indeed we have serious challenges. For the past 6 months, I've been moving around the country, and I've seen the state of our facilities, our courts, indeed in state of disrepair, derelict, and dilapidation. And as JB has said, we are seeking to engage Public Works because in the main, they are the custodian of state facilities, and most of the challenges emanate from there. We have made a request that at the least they delegate me as a director general, some financial, increase our financial delegation to 500,000 so that equally I can delegate it to the officials who are managing the courts, then they should be able to do maintenance because currently we're sitting at only 100,000 and that remains an issue that they have not yet come back to us. And we have taken this matter to the highest level that in the next few weeks, if me and the DG of Public Works are not able to find a way forward, then it will be elevated to a political level. But we are working on a proposal that will ultimately take even to cabinet to see how they can allow us to deal with the challenges because they have their own capacity challenges themselves. Now, Chair, the question you were asking me about how much we have spent on the contractors on the IJS, since its advent. Chair, you were liberal in terms of the estimation of the amount of money. The information that I've been given here, without per se showing how much went to contractors, is over 7 billion. That's the amount of money that has been spent so far. I would say that in the main, three quarters of that surely will have gone into contractors, because there was not anything else other than having the work that was being done by contractors. That was the information, but we can still confirm later the actual breakdown. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, DJ. I have a challenge to cite. Most of the time you are breaking and you're breaking up, and my bandwidth is very low. Now, thank you very much for the information. I think you will agree with me that this progress is atrocious. It's not the progress that we should expect after 24 years. Because we seem to be living in different worlds. The world of the people who are expecting service, their patience is running out. And in the world of the elite and the bureaucrats, the time is endless. They don't feel this pressure of not getting services. We feel it because we represent these people. We represent these people who are not getting services. Because, I mean, if you use the 80-20 principle, IGS, the Integrated Justice System, is one of those programs. If they can be fully implemented, they can achieve more than 80% of what we want to do in justice or in the criminal justice system. And the failure to successfully implement it, any other thing that you'll be able to successfully implement, it will constitute 20% of what you need to achieve. Now, for me, it is very irritating when I just hear about theater war rooms, infrastructure plan, government structures, plans. It's irritating. It's not what we should be getting after 24 years. Surely not. Because the issue is, DG, you must honestly reflect whether you have the type of department that is able to translate a vision into a strategy into a plan, and a plan into an implementation. Honestly reflect on that. Whether these men and women who surround you, even in other departments, because this one is not only a justice issue, whether we have men and women who can really take us, because we're not yet in the 21st century, who can even take us to the 20th century. I do think that what maybe we might need to do either next term or just before we adjourn next term is to do an oversight visit as this committee. Using the reports that you have given us, we have asked you for a number of reports. One of the reports was asked by Honorable Horn, Honorable Janji, Honorable Breitenbach. We need those reports so that we can be able to plan an oversight visit to some of these areas. Because what will be the reason of planning for a 21st century kind of a situation in Mosina when we do not have toilet or do not have electricity? Why would you think about the Wi-Fi when there's no electricity? So this generally talks to the broader performance of the state. Maybe we...
Are you there, Chair?
Maybe we should be spending a lot of time in court. Maybe that would be better. Because question, do we have men and women to translate our vision into delivery? And that is why what we recommended to the House was that the department should, the public service and administration should really answer the question whether the department is fit for purpose. So I do think that we might also need to schedule quite a number of briefings to be receiving progress reports, because if we are going to meet with you once in a year on these issues, I think after another 24 years, we'll still be getting plans. And then after a centenary, we'll still be getting plans. So I think we should be maybe on a quarterly basis ensure that we get real progress report. But we should be able also to go out because sometimes there's a difference between what is written on a report and the reality out there. So DG, we know that you are new. You have just been appointed as a DG. But all these things are directed at your department. Very soon, if you don't whip, then the minister must whip you. Those who can't translate vision into strategy, into plans, into deliverables must sweep out, DG. They must sweep out. Thank you very much, DG. Thank you very much. I think members, tomorrow we will be dealing with the briefing from the department on the hate crime. After the decision of the Constitutional Court. And then we will also deal with another thorny issue, the office of the, what is it called? Not state attorney. Yes, what is the?
Master Services.
Master Corps.
Master Services. Because we want to drill into these areas that are that are causing a lot of havoc and discomfort to our people. And we want to work with you to turn those things around. So I think DG will be seeing you tomorrow again with the team.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Members, any other issue that you want to raise before we adjourn?
We covered, Chair.
Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.